Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for the October 25th reading of The Environment, a compilation of articles from the Magazine of the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy Magazine, and Mother Earth News. My name is John. We'll start today with the following main article and then fill in as time permits. From the Magazine of the Sierra Club, we have Leaf Peeping on Two Wheels. Here's where bike lovers should head for fabulous fall foliage. Spoiler alert, it does not include Colorado. This article was written by Cassandra Brooklyn. Fall is pretty much the perfect time for everything. The sweltering summer heat has transitioned to temperatures that are more comfortable for exploring. The mosquitoes are no longer a threat, and life seems a bit more relaxed. And what better way to explore this cooler weather and relaxed pace than on two wheels? Here are some bike-friendly destinations where you can find fall foliage at its finest. Madison, Wisconsin. For a small city, Madison has an impressive array of options for cyclists and nature lovers. With over 270 parks and 200 miles of trails, this capital city makes it easy to get around without a car. In fact, it received one of only five of the coveted Platinum Bicycle Friendly Community Status Awards from the League of American Bicyclists. Madison has installed pedestrian and bicycle bridges over major highways, cross-flow bike lanes going in both directions on a one-way street, bicycle crossing signals at intersections, and an extensive network of bike lanes that connect Madison with surrounding communities. The city recently launched Madison by Bike, which offers routes and discounts when you check in at local restaurants and businesses, including getting a discount on their bike share program, B-Cycle, if you didn't bring your own wheels. This college town is also full of foliage, so most streets and paths are lined with trees shifting to vibrant oranges, yellows, and reds. Especially scenic routes can be found through the Arboretum or along and around Lake Mendota and Lake Monona. For a longer ride, hop on the Badger State Rail Trail, a former railroad line converted to a multi-use trail that runs through 40 miles of farmlands, woods, meadows, and prairies between Madison and the Wisconsin-Illinois border. Next, Bar Harbor, Maine. Acadia National Park is considered one of the best places to enjoy fall foliage, and with a good reason. Not only can this woodland wonderland be explored by foot or car via 27 miles of motor roads and 158 miles of hiking trails, but the park is also unique in that it has 45 miles of bike-friendly carriage roads, which are closed to traffic. Built by John D. Rockefeller Jr. in the early 1900s, this series of hard-packed gravel trails meander through the park's mountains and valleys, cutting through dense forests populated with spruce fir, oak, maple, and beech. 4, 6, and 11-mile loops scatter Acadia and could easily be linked together for longer rides. Because the trails are car-free, they're a relaxed way to enjoy the park and perfect for beginner cyclists and families. Experienced cyclists will also love the carriage roads, but if they're accustomed to riding in traffic, they could also bike the famous Park Loop Road. This 22-mile paved route weaves its way through Acadia and includes a stunning section where the park's granite coast bumps up against the crashing waves of the Atlantic Ocean. Bar Harbor is the gateway town to the park, where you can rent a bike and pedal directly to the park. No car required. And now, Minnesota. While Minneapolis may be best known for a 5.5-mile former rail yard corridor called the Greenway, this is just one small section of the city's 250-mile network of on- and off-street bikeways. The city was named the number one bike city by Bicycling Magazine in 2010, but their love of cycling goes back much further. According to a map from the St. Paul Cycle Path Association at the Minnesota Historical Society, bike routes linked parts of the Twin Cities as early as 1899. Today, the Grand Rounds National Scenic Byway is one of the best examples of parks being linked by bike paths. The scenic 55-mile route contains heavily wooded and foliage-filled areas along the Mississippi River waterfront, around the lake loops in the city's chain of lakes area, and through Minnehaha Park. Be sure to stop and see the massive waterfall. It's one of the country's longest continuous systems of public urban parkways. Minnesota's largest city may be full of pretty parks and lovely loops that light up in a dizzying array of colors each autumn. But for the best fall foliage, you'll have to head farther north. The Gitche-Gumbe State Trail in northeastern Minnesota follows the shore of Lake Superior, taking in breathtaking views of yellow, leaf-covered red cliffs towering over the shores of Gitche-Gumbe Ojibwe for Lake Superior. Currently, the trail has 33 miles completed, but the plan is to extend it to 88 miles, connecting five state parks along the way. One of the most stunning sections is the Gooseberry Loop, a 30-mile out-and-back loop between Gooseberry Falls State Park and Beaver Bay, which takes you past huge waterfalls and through dense coniferous forest, where various shades of green turn to brilliant reds, yellows, and orange. Riders interested in experiencing true wilderness and gravel biking may want to look into the 630-mile Northwoods route, which circumnavigates the western half of Lake Superior, stretching from northern Minnesota down to Wisconsin, then up Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Not only is Pittsburgh an excellent city for cycling, but here, Arbor abounds. Steel City is easily accessible by Amtrak, which allows you, by the way, to bring your bike on board, so it's also one of the best places for leaf peeping accessible by train. The burg is blanketed with well-marked biking trails, several following gorgeous riverfront parks that are exploding with colorful trees. For those desiring distance, follow the tree-studded bike routes to the 150-mile Great Allegheny Passage, also known as the Gap Trail. This non-motorized path begins in Pittsburgh and runs all the way to Washington, D.C., winding its way over wrought iron bridges through former railway tunnels and passing by cultural museums and historic sites. If you also enjoy hiking, bring your boots, as there will be plenty of opportunities to trek. When it comes time to rest your head, pick between dozens of comfortable campsites and bed and breakfasts along the route, but be sure to book in advance, especially over the weekend. And finally, New York. New York State is famous for many things, from food and fashion to art and architecture. Still, for some reason, those outside the Empire State are unaware of the enormous number of state parks, wilderness areas, and long-distance hiking and biking trails that crisscross the state. Upstate New York's Adirondack Park, better known simply as the Adirondacks, or to locals, the DAX, is a National Historic Landmark that is basically New York's version of a national park. Spanning an impressive 6 million acres, it is the largest publicly protected area in the contiguous United States, and its many mountains and tiny towns make it the perfect place for cycling through fiery fall foliage. Lake Placid is a great place to base yourself because you'll find many activities in town, along with great restaurants and shops specializing in locally made products. Meanwhile, in New York City, you'll find the admittedly very urban start of the Empire State Trail. This recently built trail stretches 750 miles, connecting existing cycling trails with new routes across the state. Beginning in Lower Manhattan, the route runs north to Albany, then splits west to Buffalo, which makes up the 360-mile Erie Canal Way, and north to Rouse's Point, right on the Canadian border. Both routes take you through urban centers, tiny towns, and rural communities, where impressive autumn landscapes lit up with every color imaginable. That article was written by Cassandra Brooklyn. She's a freelance writer specializing in active and outdoor travel, ethical travel, and sustainability. She's the author of the cycling guidebook, Cuba by Bike, and the founder of the offbeat travel company, Escaping New York. You can find her on Twitter at Escaping New York. And we're going to stick with the Magazine of the Sierra Club for article number 2 this afternoon. Which Best Buy labels do I need to pay attention to? You don't need to be so quick to throw things away. Luckily, there's no expiration date on common sense. Written by Adam Mintner. There's an unopened, vacuum-sealed package of tofu in the refrigerator, but the label says it was Best Buy last week. Best Buy doesn't mean that the tofu is now spoiled or unsafe to eat, but the certainty of that date still gives one pause. The likely result will be an 8-ounce addition to the 130 billion pounds of food wasted in the United States this year. Date labels inspire more than just food waste. Expiration guidelines for safety and health-oriented goods, from car seats to athletic shoes, increasingly advise tossing out those products too, even when they appear to be perfectly fine. That creates a new dilemma. How can a modern consumer balance sustainability against safety? Food labels, quality, not safety. Date labeling of foodstuffs goes back to the safety scares of the early 20th century. Instances of botulism in canned goods led manufacturers to adopt opaque codes that they stamped on their packaging to help retailers determine freshness and product quality. In the 1970s, these labels were made legible to consumers, but they had little impact on food safety because most issues arise during and after processing and by incorrect storage and handling. If you find pathogens in your food, you're not going to ship it in the first place, said Jabubik, professor of food science and nutrition at the University of Minnesota. Problems typically happen after a product is opened. The U.S. government has declined to mandate or regulate expiration dates for food, with the exception of infant formula, even as manufacturers have adopted their own confusing categories. A 2020 study found that only 50% of U.S. adults could correctly identify what best if used by and used by mean. Both refer to the manufacturer's estimate for when a product is at peak flavor or quality. Neither are about safety. Consumers, wishing to be safe, often throw out perfectly good products. I know the meaning of used by, Eubank told me, but I admit that I sometimes follow the label. That emotive decision has consequences. Multiple studies over the years have shown that the manufacturer labels encourage food waste and excess purchases. Car seats, running shoes, and helmets. Oxygen and sunlight degrade the plastic in many modern goods, raising concerns about safety gear. However, the rate of degradation isn't the same everywhere. A child's car seat that's exposed to regular sunlight in tropical Malaysia may not last as long as one parked in London. How then do manufacturers determine when a plastic car seat expires? A questionnaire sent to the world's 10 largest manufacturers of child safety seats asking for data, studies, or citations regarding how they determine expiration dates yielded only 2 partial responses. Asked if it had conducted any studies on aged car seats, Britax, the leading child safety equipment company, declined to comment. One thing is for certain. Expiration dates encourage consumers to trash their car seats. Target, one of the largest retailers in the United States, operates the high-profile car seat trade-in program, which, as recently as 2019, it has marketed as a means to ensure that children are safe. Target brags that the company has recycled 2.19 million car seats since 2016. Running shoe manufacturers are similarly reluctant to disclose their criteria and methods for judging their product's safe lifespan. A good rule of thumb is to get new running shoes every 300 to 500 miles, or roughly every 4 to 6 months if you average 20 miles per week, Adidas advises on its website. When asked for the studies and data that support this claim, the company did not respond. New Balance cited the same 300 to 500-mile range for its men's walking shoes, but failed to back it up. Manufacturers of bicycle and motorcycle helmets, some of which claim product lifespans of as little as 3 years, would not disclose their sources either. The Snell Foundation, an independent certifier of helmets that's often cited for the claim that a helmet should be replaced every 5 years, admitted that its data was never published and dates back decades. The bottom line. So what's a sustainably minded, safety-conscious consumer to do? When asked, experts in various product areas agreed on the same simple advice. Trust your senses, not the expiration dates. Regarding foodstuffs, for example, Eubank recommends that consumers follow storage and handling instructions from the manufacturer, but keep in mind that your nose is pretty good. Yvonne Sheshua, research professor in synthetic polymeric materials at the National Museum of Denmark, offered similar advice when asked how to judge the safety of bicycle helmets. If you can see cracks in your bicycle helmet, It's time to replace it, she wrote. If a helmet has been in an accident, replace it immediately. In the meantime, smart consumers should focus on extending the lifespan of their purchases through proper care rather than obsessing over expiration claims that may not be applicable to their location or lifestyle. For example, Anita Perkins, a footwear research engineer for the U.S. Army who designs combat boots, advises always untying shoes before sliding into them. Like other product experts, she recommends relying on human senses to judge when a shoe has expired. If footwear no longer fits properly or functions as needed for its intended purpose, I will discard it, she shared via email. Manufacturers want to move product, but sustainable consumption requires more from us. Luckily, there's no expiration date on common sense. The author, Adam Mintner, has been writing about waste and recycling since 2000. He's a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion and the author of Secondhand Travels in the New Global Garage Sale and Junkyard Planet Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. And we'll finish up this afternoon with an article from the Nature Conservancy magazine, Ocean of Opportunity. Barbados has committed to protect up to 30% of its massive marine space. This article was written by Matt Jenkins. As a child, long before he became a leader in Barbados' fishing community, Anderson Rogie Kinch would watch his neighbor's boats return from fishing and moor in Oystens Bay. Then he would swim out to the boats to get what people locally call grub, the part of the catch that fishermen would hold back for family and neighbors, which he would take home for a cook-up, a kind of stew made with rice and peas. There was a lot of love, he said in an interview before his death in June, and everyone had a connection with the ocean, even if you'd never been to sea yourself. That's still true for most people here. Barbados is the most easterly Caribbean island. So easterly, in fact, that it sits entirely in the strong waters of the Atlantic, while its total landmass is only 166 square miles, roughly half the size of Greater New York City, its maritime space is 430 times bigger, about the size of Florida. Caribbean nations are often referred to as small island states, but in Barbados, many people refer to their country as a large ocean state. Barbadians' connection with the sea manifests itself in myriad ways. For many people, a plunge in the ocean or the sea bath is a daily ritual, and fish nourish in Barbados. The national dish, cuckoo and flying fish, consists of a fish stew served with a polenta-like concoction of cornmeal and okra. The ubiquitous fish cutters, inexpensive yet filling sandwiches, sustain working-class Barbadians across the island. But Barbados' relationship with its piece of the Atlantic goes far beyond flying fish. In 2018, just before COVID-19, 1.36 million tourists visited Barbados annually to relax on the beaches, snorkel and dive the reefs, go on catamaran cruises, and surf and parasail. By some estimates, the tourism industry accounts for as much as 31% of the gross domestic product and 33% of jobs in the country. There's a huge tourism industry that's based on beautiful beaches and sea turtles, says Steve Schill, the Nature Conservancy's lead scientist for the Caribbean. The ocean is everything. It's really the engine of the economy. Funding a sustainable future in Barbados with blue bonds. Last year, the Nature Conservancy and the Inter-American Development Bank supported a debt conversion by the government of Barbados. As part of the Nature Conservancy's Blue Bonds for Ocean Conservation Program, this project allowed the country to reduce its international debt and will redirect an estimated $50 million into a comprehensive marine protection effort. The Nature Conservancy's work on this transaction was supported by 10 families and philanthropic organizations. Barbados' total maritime zone is a gigantic wedge-shaped tract of water that extends west into the Caribbean and 200 nautical miles east into the Atlantic. It includes everything from coastal reefs with complex ecosystems to the open ocean that's home to migratory species, including marlin, mahi-mahi, and yellowfin tuna. Barbados' maritime zone is nearly 72,000 square miles, and the government plans to protect as much as 30% of it. Barbados is so far out there, away from the Eastern Caribbean chain, that there's a lot of deep ocean, says Shell. He adds that it is exciting to see the country commit to sustainably manage its maritime zone. Yet the initiative is not about drawing lines in the water, says the University of West Indies' Patrick McConney, who together with a team at the Center for Resource Management and Environmental Studies is working with the Nature Conservancy to support the government in its marine planning process. It's about compatible uses and crafting policy that includes all of the sectors with a stake here. And in many ways, the effort will offer a forum for a wider discussion of how to sustain all the different ways the ocean is important to Barbadians far, far into the future. Putting environmental sustainability at the center of finance reform. The concept behind the Barbados Blue Bonds for Ocean Conservation is a debt-for-nature swap, an idea first tested in the 1980s. A country can negotiate an exchange of high-interest loans for lower-interest ones, essentially like refinancing a home. The nation commits to using the savings in interest payments to fund conservation efforts within its borders. The tool was initially developed to protect tropical forests, but the Nature Conservancy has helped pioneer its use in the protection and conservation of ocean habitats. In 2018, the Nature Conservancy announced the first such agreement with the Indian Ocean nation of Seychelles. In 2021, it launched a second one with Belize in Central America. In Barbados, the Nature Conservancy found a natural partner. Mia Motley took office as the country's first female prime minister in 2018 and was determined to tackle the country's finances. But there was more. We put environmental sustainability at the center of the reform of the public finances, says Ryan Strawn, Barbados finance minister. And, he adds, it has evolved very quickly into how are we going to use the building of climate resilience as an element to drive sustainable growth? Barbados will direct the $50 million in interest payment savings into the newly created Barbados Environmental Sustainability Fund as an endowment to allow the fund to operate in perpetuity. The fund is overseen by an 11-member board that is charged with evaluating and funding proposals for conservation, climate resilience, and sustainable development projects. Gregory Hinkson, the principal consultant and managing director of SAMDOR, a Barbados-based financial advisory firm, is the chair of the fund. He likens it to a green version of the long-running reality show Shark Tank, which provides seed money to promising ideas. You often need that little push to move the idea forward, he says, because without that, you never know what it will turn into. Developing the first five-year marine spatial plan for Barbados. But roughly half of the fund's money is earmarked for a much bigger undertaking, creating a marine spatial plan for Barbados' entire exclusive economic zone, EEZ. That effort, which will unfold over 5 years, will combine scientific knowledge with a broad public participatory effort to develop a plan for how various parts of the country's marine territory are managed and what areas should receive protection. The marine spatial planning is a critical component of the Blue Bond, says Strawn. Until now, we haven't taken a comprehensive look at our resources throughout the entire EEZ and thought about how we manage the resources for the long-term benefit of the country. The marine spatial planning process will bring together stakeholders from many economic sectors, including fishing and fish processing, seaweed and fish farming, tourism and diving, oil and gas development, and renewable energy. With these stakeholders, the government will lead the development of ecological, economic, and socio-cultural goals and objectives for the marine spatial planning process. They will create a map of ecologically significant areas in Barbadian waters, overlay that with the areas that are important to various sectors, and then work to resolve conflicts so marine protection and resource use can be balanced to the greatest possible extent. Marine spatial planning is all about bringing the stakeholders together and asking, what is your vision for the future? What are the conflicts that you can help us identify? What are your values? And let's listen to your voice, says the Nature Conservancy's Shill. There will be some hard negotiations, I'm sure, says Shelley Ann Cox, Barbados' chief fisheries officer. But it's only when we have these difficult conversations and discussions that we find a clear balance. For all its technical aspects, the marine spatial planning process offers a chance to create a vision that melds the many aspects of Barbados' environment, economy, and identity. I think it's going to be a tool for figuring out how Barbados keeps moving forward, says Allison Wiggins, a deputy project manager with the Coastal Zone Management Unit, which will be leading the process. And I think it's going to be a way to show the world that a small island with scarce resources can do this major work largely on its own with help from partners like the Nature Conservancy. But even more than that, I think it's a way to show the world what is best about Barbados. And with that, we'd like to thank you for joining us for the October 25th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.